Hi everyone, welcome back to the Haworth Timber and Building Supplies 1840 podcast. I'm your host Paul Bullivant, and on today's episode we're going to be talking about the history of the Haworth Timber Group, going right back to our humble origins in 1840 and then moving right forward to today, where we find ourselves one of the UK's largest privately owned builders, merchants and timber group. To help me in that conversation, I've got somebody with me who's been pivotal to that growth over the years and really does have the business coursing through his veins. A big warm welcome to Nick Haworth. Hello, Nick.
You're welcome, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
Good. Pleased to have you with us. Shall we just start by letting you introduce yourself?
Okay.
Because there'll be people, obviously, who don't know you.
Well, I'm Nicholas Haworth. I'm joint chair of the Haworth Timber Group with my brother, Andrew. But also, I'm the CEO of Haworth Timber and Building Supplies.
Okay. Anything that you could add about yourself personally?
Yeah, well, yes.
Because people within the business know you as the MD, but I'm sure they'll be interested in hearing a bit about Nick,
well,
the man behind the MD.
I grew up in Leeds. I went to Leeds Grammar School, and then I went to Manchester University,
okay,
with a management degree. And then, actually quite unusually then for the time, I kind of did a gap year. I sort of travelled most of the way around the world.
Okay.
And back then it was before the internet, before mobile phones, in fact, before most places had dial-up exchanges. So if you wanted to make a call from, you know, say when I was in Afghanistan or Iraq or Myanmar or Burma as it is now, etc., you had to go to a local telephone exchange and book a call a month ahead.
Okay.
So, and then I joined the business.
Mm-hmm.
Became the manager of our Thorn branch, which okay, was one of our smaller branches and still is. And then after a couple of years there, I went and took over the management of our Wakefield branch,
okay,
which again is still one of our bigger, more successful branches.
Yeah, okay, that's great. Any interesting stories from your travels? You said you went to like Afghanistan and you're right, places that you think nowadays you wouldn't want to travel
to.
Yeah,
well, I think people used to laugh at the time because wherever I went, kind of the year afterwards had a revolution or an invasion. And it was like the last time you could like travel through the Middle East and Iran and into Afghanistan without, because after that it just became what it's been for the last 40 odd years, which is, revolution and wars.
Did you, looking back, is there anything that you learnt about yourself doing that kind of travel?
Very much so. Started off with three friends in a Land Rover, and we'd like travel through Europe, Middle East, around Afghanistan, and into India together. But then we had different timetables, so we split up.
Okay.
So the last few months, I was just kind of traveling by myself.
Right.
And through India and sort of Southeast Asia. Although there were limits on what you could do in Southeast Asia then, because that's when Pot Pol was doing his massacres in Cambodia. Because, of course, Southeast Asia now is relatively calm,
yep,
but really a big tourist destination, but it wasn't there because it was just shortly after the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, okay.
So there was still a lot of turmoil in Southeast Asia then. But actually, I felt I learned more in that 1 year of travelling than I did 3 years at university, because it really, you had to be very self-reliant.
Yep.
And obviously, when you're like travelling, you've got time to self-reflect and think. So, I really felt I kind of grew up and learned more in that 1 year than I did 3 years at university.
Yeah, interesting. My wife, she's, over the years, she's lived in America and Canada, and she says that they were really good points in the life, becoming to stand on your own 2 feet away from your, away from your culture.
Yep.
Okay, that's good. So today we're going to focus on the history of the business.
Yeah.
In particular, I want to focus on what I would call the modern era of the business, so kind of from your father onwards. But before we do that, do you want to just give some context about Haworth Timber today, who we are, what we are?
Yeah, well, as you said, Paul, the business started in 1840. It was, in fact, started by the father-in-law of my great-great-great-grandfather, a guy called William Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was called Hudson & Co. right through till about 50 years ago, when the name changed to Haworth Timber. My father made that change. It started off as a a timber merchant in Leeds, yep. Single site. And my family's always been involved in the business, right back to my great-great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-great-grandfather even. And but the family only had a minority share in it. Mm-hmm. And say my grandfather, actually, he was the foreman of the sawmill.
Right.
Because back in those days, merchants had quite big sawmills because they used to do a lot of homegrown timber. So they'd actually bring in logs and saw the logs down to make planks,
yep.
As well as buying in pre-machine timber from, a lot of it was from Canada,
yep.
And then latterly more from Scandinavia, where most timber's sourced now,
yep.
And a sort of limited range of sheet materials, because back then, back then there was really only chipboard and plywood. So that was what the business was. It had been loss-making for many years. My father went into the bear business in the kind of late 50s. My father was a clever guy. He'd gone to Oxford University, worked in industry, but then decided to join the family business where, as I said, my grandfather had about 15% of the shares.
Okay.
But it'd been loss-making for many, many years, and he agreed with the shareholders that if he went in the bear business and turned it round and made it profitable, he would buy them out at a predetermined figure.
Okay.
Which he did. And that took probably through till the sort of mid-60s. And then after that, that is when the company started expanding.
Yeah.
And also then in the 60s, actually it was quite a benign environment because there was like lots of housing being built. And they were still reconstructing after the damage of the Second World War. So demand was quite good. And, the business, as you say, became very successful under my father,
yep.
Partly due to market conditions, but also due to, if you like, his brilliance at managing.
His acumen.
The big business, yes.
Yeah. And then bringing forward to where we are today.
Okay.
Can give some context?
Yeah. As I say, I heard... worked in the bit business when I was at school and through university. Like many family firms, my father bought the bit business home with him. And so we'd talk about it over the dinner table, okay. And at home. And then my earliest experiences of the company were actually on Saturday mornings, my father going to work, I would go in and be there and just kind of hang out.
Yeah.
This is when I was quite young, and they did that quite often. And then when I was sort of 14, I started going and working there, either in the like shop counter, like serving on the counter, which has always helped because my mental arithmetic's been good since, because it was all very manual, and had to do the sums quick in your head. And then also, I'd work in the yard when I was a bit older, and
how were you treated by the staff in the branch as the son of the?
Well, obviously they were always aware of that, and I always kind of worked hard and contributed, and I've never been the kind of arrogant person, so I'd never try and ever lord it over it. Anybody, because I've always respected people's experience and knowledge, and so I'd say vast majority I was accepted well. And then I said by the time I was probably about 15, because there wasn't much health and safety in those days, I was kind of driving forklifts and side loaders and operating machinery.
I've got a story I'd like to ask you about around forklifts and what have you. And I'm pleased you've mentioned health and safety, because we wasn't sure where to mention it. And this comes from an old colleague and friend of yours, Steve Baxter at Wakefield. Yeah. He seems to have a plethora of stories.
Yes. I employed Steve when I was managing Wakefield. And he kind of started as a 16-year-old.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So he's got two stories that he was telling me yesterday.
Yeah.
He couldn't stop laughing. The first one is over, you were doing a stock take with him one day.
Yeah.
And Steve was going to drive the forklift, but you said, no, get out of the way. I'm going to drive the forklift.
Yeah.
And you drove up a ramp, got to the top, jumped out, forgot to put a handbrake on, and the forklift started rolling back and nearly went into the canal. Is that really what happened?
I don't remember that exact incident, but I probably had so many incidents like that I've forgotten that particular one.
Well, Steve said we were very lucky. There was a lump of wood at the bottom of the slope. And if it hadn't been for that, we'd been having a side loader.
I remember back in the 1980s, the canal that runs past the Wakefield branch, you could always tell what the in fashion colour was for next season in clothes.
Right.
Because the canal would turn into that colour.
Because
it was a very large textile and clothes manufacturing around Wakefield. Yeah. This is in the 90s. This is sort of 40-odd years ago. So they used to dye the clothes, and they're obviously environmental things weren't as strong those days either. So all the chemicals from the clothing factories used to end up in the canal, and the canal would change colour.
I think there's a regular theme here about health and safety improving over the years.
Yeah, well, it has done, yes, which is a good thing.
Yeah, good. His other story that I think is well told within the business, but would be interesting to share for the viewers, is the one about Steve having to help you with a forklift to lift your Bentley up after getting a puncture in the car park.
Yes, that's correct. I had to change the wheel because I'd lost the jack or whatever. So,
well, he said the problem was that in the car park there were kind of, the land had subsided. So by the time you'd had a flat, it had got that low that you couldn't actually get the jack underneath the car. So he needed to get on a forklift.
Yes, that incident happened. Yeah,
and he said you were getting a few honks and waves by the cars as they came past the nice car being lifted on a forklift.
Yes. Yep.
Good. So you kind of worked through your business. You've earned your stripes, and then you became a branch manager.
Yes, I was manager of the Thorn branch. Okay. Yep, for a couple of years before I then went to manage the Wakefield branch.
Yeah. Okay. And then after the Wakefield branch, that would be when.
Yeah. Well, as if sort of sadly, my kind of father got prostate cancer when he was in his late 50s.
Okay.
He passed away when he was 62, 1988.
Yep.
So, but I only really knew that he was he had cancer and he was terminally ill for about a year or so because he kind of didn't really tell anybody, for the first two or three years that he had cancer.
But did he, for that last kind of year, 18 months, had he told you then that...
He did for the last year or so, yes.
Okay.
And... obviously, it was a very big shock because, it was a very big person in my life. And 62 is a young age to die.
The custody, yeah. Did he, could you feel, after he'd made you aware that he was ill, were you consciously aware of him trying to speed up your experience and education?
Yes, I kind of, my brother went to Howard Timber & Porters, which is now Arbor Forest Products, to sort of manage that side of the group, and I focused more on the merchanting side and the sort of the timber engineering sort of roof truss manufacturing side.
Okay. So when at the point when your father passed, you and Andrew then took over the leadership of the business.
Yes, we became joint chair of Howard Timber Group, and Andrew's always focused more on the New Holland site.
Okay.
With the and the dock, and I've kind of always... But we also had a window factory at the time. I got involved in the window factory, and I did, in fact, run that as, if like, CEO of that for a number of years, along with being CEO of Howard Timber & Building Supplies. But then I stepped away from that just to focus more on Howard Timber & Building Supplies and also the engineered timber side of Howard Timber as well.
How did you go down the path of Building Supplies and Andrew of Timber Importers? Well, was it just natural?
It was sort of natural. In essence, my father asked Andrew to manage that side, and which I think was actually before he told us that he was terminally ill. And I kind of gravitated more towards the non-New Holland parts of the group.
So it's quite a natural
move into the size of this. Because the group's got five companies in it.
Okay.
Uh,
yep.
and they are all quite siloed.
Yep.
With their own market specialisms, their own management teams, their own strategies and plans and budgets. Mm-hmm. But we do have a number of other group structure. So where it's makes sense to do things on a group wide basis because there's economies of scale or synergy, then we do. Such as treasury and finance. So we have a group finance director that looks after treasury and oversees the overall accounting functions. Okay. And also sort of governance structures. And then also for insurances are all done at a group level. Also with health and safety, that's done at a group level. HR, there's a group level function there.
Yep.
And also our IT systems, the network is group managed.
Okay.
Along with cybersecurity.
Yeah.
But the individual application programs are managed within the
individual businesses.
Companies, yes, because okay. They've got different ERP systems just for their needs.
Just taking you back a little bit to that point in your life when your father passed away and you took on the business. They're two big moments in anybody's life. Kind of pick your brains a little bit around resilience, because to handle those two things at the same time would take a huge amount of resilience. How did you cope with the two things?
Sure. So resilience has never been a problem for me. I've always just kind of got on with the job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously it had bigger and greater responsibilities, you know, which I stepped into, as did Andrew. But, you know, it would just keep evolving and growing and managing what was already there.
Okay.
And evolving it over time and growing it over time.
So to a degree, you were able to just compartmentalise the personal side and the business side as much as you could.
Yeah.
Do you think resilience is a real Howarth family trait? And I say that based on looking at the history of the of the business. There's been a lot of ups and downs through the years.
I believe so, yes. Obviously, I can only speak for the people I know, which is probably my grandfather, my father, obviously Andrew, myself, our children. So, you know, I'd say, you know, we're all fairly well-grounded and resilienced and, you know, I think have good traditional Yorkshire common sense.
Yeah, yeah. That's good, yeah. Can you teach resilience, do you think, or is it just a natural trait?
I think it's an attitude of mind because, and I suppose it helps to some extent the older you get.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of things you've seen before because life tends to go around in cycles. And, you know, for example, our industry is having a challenging time at the moment with market conditions, but you know that happens every 15 years.
Yeah.
So when you've seen it, you know, sort of three of the cycles like I've had, you know, you learn not to get too morose when things are very difficult.
Yeah. Okay.
But conversely, you know, you don't get overexcited when things
are too high. So to be balanced,
because you know, well, what goes up is going to come down again.
Yeah.
That's the way. And what you've got to do is keep moving the business forward and evolving within that environment.
Yeah,
okay. A bit like a ship on the sea. It goes up and down with the waves, but it keeps moving forward.
Yeah, okay, that's good. You hear that quite a lot from sports people around not letting the highs be too high and the lows too low. You've got to keep, you know, you've got to keep consistent. When you and Andrew took over the reins, did you ever think the business would be the size it is today?
Well, I think we both had ambitions for the business to be successful and grow. You know, we've never had a set plan to be a set size.
Yep.
You know, lots of businesses do that, but that's with more of a view of, say, if you are you want to, you know, list on the exchange, stock exchange, or you wish to, if you're a private equity firm, reach a certain size to aggregate up and buy out with a higher multiple. But you know, that's not our game plan. Our game plan is to evolve and grow the business, and you know, evolving and changing the business is important to growing it.
Okay.
You know, because you know what we want to be isn't the biggest business there is, but you know, one of the most, if not the most successful businesses. And by success, that's not just financial, it's successful in terms of, respected by customers, respected by suppliers, colleagues within the bear business like and respect the business and enjoy working in it. All those things are important.
Okay. So you've been MD of the business for 38 years, is it?
Yes. Well, we actually, Howarth Timber and Building Supplies, when I took it over, was a number of individual branches, and each branch was its own limited company.
Oh, right. Okay.
So back in the late 90s, so probably 25, 30 years ago, we bought all the businesses together into one company.
Yep.
And that was assisted by our computer systems at the time,
okay,
that allowed everything to be brought together,
yep,
with branches.
Yep.
As against before then, everything was quite manual. And each company had its own like computer system, produced, okay, its own accounts. Each branch stroke company had its own accountant, produced its own accounts, which, yep, were, you know, audited and filed at company's house.
Okay. So over that 38 years that you've been MD, you're bound to have had lots of highs and lows.
Yep.
And you said you tried to keep them balanced. Are there any? Could you give us an example of a high that's made you really proud of what you've done, and a low, and what kind of lesson you'd learnt from it? Because that's, you know, learning from mistakes and what's happened to other people is a really good way for all of us to.
Yeah, I'd say high is, you know, as I say, there's not one big event,
yep,
and not one that's positive, and not one big event that is really negative.
Yep.
It's lots of good events of different types and magnitude, and also quite a lot of negative events,
yeah,
of different sizes and magnitude.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I would say success is when, you know, people develop and grow within the business.
Yeah.
You know, I get a lot of positives from that, such as, you know, we've appointed three regional managers up from who were branch managers, yeah, to just earlier this year. So, you know, that's always a, you know, big positive for me. Sort of negative. Again, it was, you know, it's disappointment. We had a few years ago, somebody who was previously being a branch manager, he didn't get a promotion and he became quite negative. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had a couple of people that fell within that remit and stayed within the business, and yeah, they were undermining the business and upsetting colleagues. And, you know, that was, you know, it was dealt with, but it was, you know, difficult for me, because I felt that was not really fair, what they were doing to both the business, but also the colleagues that they were upsetting.
Did that make you lose faith in people?
No, it didn't make me lose faith in people, because, you know, there's all different types of people, you know. I know there's, like, axe murderers and rapists out there, but that doesn't put me off people as a whole.
Very good. What? So obviously the business has been in the family for a very long, very long time. What are the pluses and negatives of running a family business?
Well, I think the positives are that you take a long-term view of things. So unlike a PLC, which has to, you know, report every 6 months, and if things aren't going to plan, need to take drastic action to turn around, often that action is probably excessive or not properly thought through. Or if you're a private equity, it's all about doing what you need to do to sell the business out in 5 or so years time,
yeah,
rather than what's good for the business longer term. And I always, you know, I believe that, you know, having a business that is stable and having a business with a longer term growth plan is better, and that creates, if you like, stability.
Yeah.
It creates an environment where you can allow people to be experimental and entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if it goes wrong and, you know, it costs you a bit, well, that's not the end of the day,
yeah,
end of the world. And you know, merchanting is one of the few things where actually, you know, industries where being entrepreneurial's important, successful.
Yep.
Because it's almost a perfect market if you're an economist, because there's lots of suppliers and lots of customers, and human relationships are very important, because it is a business to business. It's people buying and selling from people still. And those human relationships and, you know, trusting people within the branches to make the right decisions, but within an overall environment of obviously monitoring and control, so things don't spiral badly off on a tangent, is good. And you know, what I was surprised, we carried out some market research over summer at what younger tradespeople wanted.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've been investing very heavily in our website and app.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the world is moving towards e-commerce.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But actually, merchanting is a lot more traditional still in its the way people buy than most retail now. And, you know, we found that actually the most important thing for younger tradespeople is the relationships they have with people in, in the branch.
Yep.
The way it always has been whilst I've worked in it, and I suppose going back through time before then. Although, obviously, e-commerce is important to them, and they use it more for business services than transacting and buying. So, you know, the fact that, you know, we've got, you know, an award-winning, one of the best e-commerce and, you know, app platforms within the industry is good, because, you know, the industry is moving that way. And our website and e-commerce obviously makes money now, but, you know, for a number of years at the start, it was just putting money in
and not getting the return.
But, you know, we did that again because, you know, being a private company, we can sort of take that longer-term view. I think also culture-wise as well, I think family businesses tend to have a more sort of open, friendly culture than a lot of PLCs and private equity firms. And, you know, what's heartening for me is that, yes, we get labour turnover, but actually we've got an awful lot of people who do stay with us many years.
And then on the negative side, are there any negatives? For example, an obvious one must be, you can't turn off from it because it's not a job, it's a...
Yeah, it is. That's more so for me. But there again, I enjoy what I do.
Yep.
So I don't dread coming to work, even coming to a podcast like this, which I've never done before. It's another challenge. And I suppose organisationally, the main limitation of a sort of private firm, finding a bit business, is you can't go out and get external finance to grow rapidly.
Yeah.
So, you know, a PLC, it can do a rights issue more shares, get money in to expand quickly. A private equity that gets lots of borrowed money in, which, you know, was a better model when interest rates were 0.5% rather than where they are now.
Yeah, okay.
So you know, that business model actually in a cyclical industry is now showing the strains.
Yeah.
But it does let you go out and double the size of the company in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, okay.
Which, you know, you can't do, because all our growth is based on retained profits and internal finance. And, you know, we always have, you know, kept, you know, 85% of our profits that we make within the business to reinvest back.
Okay. So allowing for the fact that work and your private life are just intrinsically linked, it's not, you never shut off from it. How do you get away from work when you want to? What are the things that you used to?
Well, I've never found it difficult to relax.
Okay.
You know, I've always found it very easy, head hit the pillow, to sleep. I mean,
that's a good knack if you can sleep well.
There's been obviously occasions when, you know, there's a particularly significant problem that you spend more time thinking about, and then it does.
But what hobbies have you got to switch off?
Well, I've had a number of hobbies. A lot of them I've carried forward.
Yeah.
So I've always been good at swimming.
Right.
Because when I was, I've had my eyes done now.
Okay.
But when I was like young at school, there weren't such things as contact lenses and the glasses actually were glass, not plastic. So you couldn't really play any contact sports. You know, you couldn't play cricket or rugby or football or anything like that with your glasses on in case, you know, you got hit and you got big piece of glass stuck in your eye. But if I stretched my hand out, I could hardly count how many fingers. So I didn't really play any sort of main sports at schools. Yep. But I was quite good at swimming. And that's something I've always kept up with. I was never a really good swimmer because my legs are too big and fat.
Like dragging so you sank.
In the water. But I was, you know, sort of a good swimmer, you know, one of the best in the school. So that's something I've kept through. Okay. And I got into scuba diving when I was 15.
Right, yep.
I joined the Leeds branch of the British Sub Aqua Club. Okay. And I got into scuba diving. I did a lot of that.
Do you dive still?
I still dive, yeah. I became an instructor. I got to the highest amateur qualification you can get as a scuba diver. And I still dive now, but I only dive where the water's warm.
Warm and, and clear.
These days and clear, yeah. So,
how deep have you dived?
About 40 metres, okay, yeah. Because some people go deeper with sort of mixed gases now, but they weren't really around when I was doing the bulk of my diving. So I did most of my diving when I was in my 20s.
Yeah, okay.
And when I was young, I was an RAF cadet.
Okay.
And I went off and got my gliding wings when I was 17. I don't think they allow cadets to do that. And I think there was too many deaths because literally...
You've had a lot of brushes with the health and safety. Yeah, you
went to an RAF base and they turned up sort of Saturday morning and they do about half a dozen joint launches with you. And then they catapult...
Just leave you to it.
Then they catapult you up to 1,000 feet, when literally you probably had about 20 minutes flying experience. And if you do it now with an amateur gliding club, you know, you've got weeks and weeks and weeks and hours and hours and hours before they let you loose. But they're letting these sort of 17-year-olds up on these fruit packing cases with wings on to try and fly a circuit and land back on.
This is where all your resilience skills are built, isn't it? It's either die or fly.
So I actually then got into flying. And I got my pilot's license and I sort of flew for probably 25 years.
Oh, amazing. Have I heard a story that we used to have a company plane?
Yeah. Well, you used to have a company plane, because my brother, also a pilot, he used to, Arbor Forest Products used to use it to fly out to Scandinavia and Russia.
Yeah.
And I used to use it for internal flights as well.
Okay.
And I did one or two Scandinavian trips as well. So did that. And
any near-death experiences when flying?
No, not really, fortunately. And then through my scuba diving, when I was in my 20s, I got into a game called underwater hockey.
Okay.
Which, it's like most sports, the Brits invented it, but the rest of the world kicks their ass at it now. I've played that for about 40 years. In fact, I played last night at John Charles Pool. Okay. Here in Leeds, so I still play that.
Oh, so you're still and you horse ride as well, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a happy hacker. I go out, rent a horse.
Nice.
On a Sunday morning for an hour. Sometimes do longer rides.
So you live a really full life between work and all of that.
Yeah, I like to go cycling too.
Okay, great.
So I keep myself busy. I've always kept myself active and fit.
And fit. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay, that's good. So when I was researching for this, I was using our Howard Timber book to do some background reading. And I remember when I joined the business and I was given a book, I thought it was really impressive that the business had a book itself. I've got a couple of things I want to ask you out of it. But what was the background to having a book written?
Well, we did the first one in 1990 when the company was celebrated its 150 years.
Yeah.
We did that in 2015, when the company was celebrating its 175 years, and no doubt, you know, in 15 years' time, we'll do a 200 anniversary book in 2040.
You must be really proud of having that.
Yeah, well, it is, particularly the first one, because the first one, my granddad was still alive.
Okay.
And also other people who, if you like, had longer memories of the business.
Okay.
So there was a lot of the background information that was put in there from people that were kind of interviewed by the author that's been captured. And also, the same author was still around in 2015.
Okay.
So he actually just
continued the story.
Not quite sure whether he'll be there in 2040, though.
I guess, like anything, when I joined the business and I read it, skim read it to get the, and you focus on the more recent parts. But in researching for this, there's some real stories in amongst it. There's probably enough stories to do another podcast episode around the stories. But there's two things out of it that I would like to just ask you about. The book says, Andrew confesses that he can never remember having a crossword in business with his brother.
Yeah.
But on your brother's, there must be a crossword.
No. I'd say within business, maybe help because the business is quite siloed and he runs more the Arbor Forest product side and the New Holland's dock side. I tend to run more the merchants and get involved more in the our timber engineered solution side, although that has its own CEO, so it's very much like an arm's length sort of role I have within that. We've also now obviously got the company acquired recently, Verdon Timber, that my nephew manages. He's CEO of that. You know, we respect each other. Our businesses have been successful. And, you know, we've sort of both, you know, get on well.
That's excellent. Yeah. That's good to see. Because it must be challenging at times working with a brother or a father that you...
It is, you know, if something's important to us, then, you know, we generally sort of say, okay, yeah, that's fine. Let's, you know, if you want to do that, do it. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And then my second question, the second thing I'd like to just bring from it and ask you about. The book talks about your father's only concession to Well was a Rolls Royce with a distinctive number plate H4 that rarely came out of the garage.
Yes, yeah.
What's your memories of that? And where's the H4 number plate gone?
My brother's, it's still owned by the car company, but I think it's on one of my brother's cars.
At
the moment. I've never really been much into personalised number plates.
Okay.
I've never really had one.
Yeah.
Just the same way I'm kind of wearing a Citizen watch. I'm not into Rolexes or anything like that. So that's where that is the memories of the car. Well, actually, my father didn't use it that much. I think he just decided to have one. In fact, although the business wasn't successful until my father went into it, you know, in the 1960s, and my grandfather was the sort of mill foreman of that one site. And he stayed doing that until he retired. You know, my father bought him a Rolls Royce.
Really?
And that was actually, I thought was a better one because he bought that before he got his own. And it was like one of the old classic looking ones rather than the boxing
ones.
The new ones. Ever been since it was, you know, one of the old, looked like a 1940s, 50s one, you know, with the you know,
all the rolls and curves.
The rolls and curves,
Oh, cool, that's good. I'm going to start drawing things to a close for now.
Yeah.
I think we're going to need another episode because there are a number of other stories from the book that I think are worthy of talking about.
I better read the book than have
quickly.
Read it for 40 and, years.
and obviously there are builders merchants issues that I think would be good to get your views on today rather than just looking at the past and the history of the business. So we'll come back to those. But I'm trying to finish, or we're trying to finish these podcast episodes off with a set of quick fire questions that we ask to everybody.
Okay, go ahead.
Just to get some kind of general views and opinions on how people work. So here we go. What makes a great leader and what makes a high-performing team?
I'd say the two go together because I think, you know, you got to have a good leader for a high-performing team. And I'd say a good leader builds and supports a high-performing team and gets everybody sort of working cohesively, but, you know, not rigidly. And I believe a great leader lets people who are good and he's got confidence in, experiment and do their own things, and then the team as a whole learn from that and evolve and move forward together. And, you know, having a, you know, I'm a great believer in, you know, what people are talking about more, which is try quick and fail quick.
Yep.
And, you know, I think, you know, that is part of the culture of a good team.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, you've got to have a good team building a good culture within the organisation and also having a direction of travel and plan.
Okay, that's great. Favourite part of your job?
Seeing people succeed and do well. I referred through to the promotions. You know, we promote a lot internally.
Yes, yeah.
I think, you know, Paul Ferns, our older manager, mentioned that in one of your previous podcasts.
So that's what
I don't like is well, not so much myself, but for other people, given the fact we are in a cyclical industry, in spite of people doing their best, market turns against you, and you know, financially, you know, business units don't perform. And I know that is difficult for me, but you know, it's also difficult for other people, particularly people who probably haven't seen the cyclical nature of our industry as much as me.
The most difficult part of your job?
I'd say the most difficult part of the job is, I mentioned the couple of people who sort of turned negative and didn't get the promotion, but also, you know, conversely, it's when, you know, you appoint somebody to a position and, you know, in spite of their best efforts, they're just not the right person for that role.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, their performance is undermining their team because, you know, they're not leading it properly and probably actually really hurting and damaging them as well.
Yeah.
And then having to, you know, remove them out of that position.
Yeah, okay, that's good. This was the final one. I've thought of another one I'm going to ask after this. The best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Well, I'd say the best piece of advice is, I have shared it before at company conferences, is every day is a school day.
Okay.
Because the world is changing. In fact, the world is changing faster than it's ever done.
Yeah.
So the only constant is change. And I think big part of that's driven by technology, and you've got to keep evolving and learning and adapting, which, you know, I've always I've enjoyed that. I've enjoyed the challenge of adapting to change. You know, for example, you know, the what we're doing with, you know, artificial intelligence within the business to you know, evolve the business and improve it using that, you know, because if you don't, an organization that doesn't evolve then becomes obsolete and dies. Okay.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
And I've got a final question that's just sprung to mind while we're talking about this. How do you feel after your first go at podcasting?
Fine. I'm quite relaxed about it.
Have you enjoyed it?
I've enjoyed it, yeah. I think the almost the town hall address will be more challenging because, you know, you get... it'll be live and there'll be more sort of probably opportunity for curveball questions, etc.
So mine have all been quite straight.
Yeah. Well, I'm quite knowledgeable about the company and I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
I thank you for believing in us and having a go at something like this, because this is not normal builders merchants behaviour. But it is really insightful listening to you talking about the history and what have you. So thank you for coming on.
I think we
will be having you back because, as I say, I've got loads of more stuff out of the book that we could talk about, plus getting your thoughts on the builders merchants industry as a whole. To our viewers and listeners, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back again soon. Thank you.
1, 2, 3.